If you're new here, my name is Joel, and we're in the book of Samuel in the Old Testament. King David is the main personality in the book of Samuel. He's the kind of key player. His son Absalom has just got back into the city of Jerusalem, into the capital city, in spite of the fact that a couple of years before this, he was responsible for the murder of his brother Amnon. Absalom has kind of snaked his way back into the city through the maneuvering of Joab, who's the military commander. He wanted to put Absalom back in place so that there might be a smooth succession plan if King David was going to die, which he's likely to die soon. David's getting old, and it's all kind of who's going to be on the throne next. And so Absalom's kind of been lined up. And today what I want us to see from him is actually how fake he is. The man is not authentic. There's a massive gap in his life. And so Absalom is the kind of person we can learn from to see whether we really understand what authenticity is or even what fakeness is. And we're learning a lot from his character as we go through his story. So come with me through these last few verses of chapter 14. I'm going to read to you from verse 25 onwards, and then we'll get into what it has to say to us. Now, in all Israel, there was no one so much to be praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. And when he cut the hair of his head, for at the end of every year he used to cut it, when it was heavy on him, he cut it, he weighed the hair of his head, 200 shekels by the king's weight. There were born to Absalom three sons and one daughter, whose name was Tamar. She was a beautiful woman. So Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem without coming into the king's presence. Then Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king, but Joab would not come to him. And he sent a second time, but Joab would not come. Then he said to his servants, "See, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire." So Absalom's servants set the field on fire. Then Joab arose and went to Absalom at his house and said to him, "Why have your servants set my field on fire?" Absalom answered Joab, "Behold, I sent word to you, come here that I may send you to the king to ask, 'Why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me to be there still. Now, therefore, let me go into the presence of the king. And if there is guilt in me, let him put me to death.'" Then Joab went to the king and told him, and he summoned Absalom. So he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. So I'm going to use this to talk about three sides to Absalom's fakeness, actually. It's really a whole kind of trail of inauthenticity. And I want us to kind of examine each part as the story unfolds. We see from the start this kind of fake glory. Absalom is a glorious person as far as the people of his time are concerned. As far as his own culture seems to see things, Absalom is covered in glory. But the writer of this story wants you to know that the glory is questionable. It's shallow. It's not real. It's not real. And you see that early on when it's describing him physically. In all Israel, there was no one so much to be praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom. His handsome appearance is what makes him praiseworthy. Perhaps the powerful silence about anything other than his appearance ought to cause us to think. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. And then it goes on to describe the weight of his hair, which obviously, you know, in our culture, it's not exactly the way we measure people up. It's not, you know, I don't see it in many Sunday supplement magazines, you know, who's in, who's out, whose hair weighs the most. That's what we really want to know. When you try and weigh your hair in the barbershop, it doesn't go down well. They look confused at you. So this you've got to just see yourself as in a time when that was the way of, or a way of evaluating someone's glory. I'm obviously very grateful we belong to a different time. when people's glory is shown more through hair coming out of the other end of their head. And actually having a lot less hair is very glorious, actually. It's a very attractive thing, as my wife will tell me and reassure me from time to time. Actually, when I was an undergraduate, I had very Absalom-like hair. I had really stupid long ringlets. My hair is naturally curly, and it went all the way down. If I pulled it, it went down to about my waist. But when I pinged it, it went back up to about here. It was a really tight corkscrew curls. And obviously you try these things in an effort to get attention from the opposite sex. And it did work. I got attention from girls. But after about 6 months, I began to realize it was not working, because all that was happening was they were looking at my hair and wishing they had it. They didn't wish they had me. They would say to me, "I love your hair." Oh, yeah, carry on, sister. I like this. Carry on. "I love your hair. I wish I had your hair." Oh, that's not what I want to hear. So I quickly went the other route. That was my decision. And very quickly after that, got engaged. So there you go. So anyway, this, you've got to put yourself in that context. It's all about the hair, but it's not just about that. It's about the glorious appearance. It's about the dazzling display of handsomeness. And he is impressive. And actually, the book of Samuel's quite clear on this in a few different ways. If you read the whole book of Samuel through, you'll notice it's one of the recurring themes. You know, sometimes when you read, if you're getting to know your Bible, look at each book almost like a piece of music and see which kind of themes come back. You know, in an amazing piece of music, you get different strains and chords and themes that come back, and tunes and melodies. One of them in Samuel is the difference between appearance and stature on the outside and genuine stature on the inside, as God sees it, as God evaluates. So there are a couple of key places, like when the first king of Israel, King Saul, is identified, he's identified as head and shoulders above his companions. He's physically imposing and impressive, and because of that, people quickly recognize him as an obvious king. He's physically impressive. And it's the same story a few chapters later, 1 Samuel 16, when the prophet Samuel himself goes to the house of Jesse to choose the next king after Saul has basically failed. Samuel is sent to anoint King David. Now, David's a shepherd boy, and Samuel doesn't even notice him. In fact, Samuel is so dazzled by David's biggest brother, Eliab, that he assumes that Eliab is the guy, and he's about ready to anoint him with oil, and God has to step in and say, don't, it's not him. And Samuel goes through the whole kind of, you know, Jesse's Got Talent kind of display of all these guys showing how impressive they are. And in each case, Samuel's like, yeah, obviously, if it's not him, it must be him. Until we get to this kind of boy out in the field with the sheep, it's David, who wasn't even picked for the display. And this is a theme throughout the Bible, certainly in Samuel, the danger of us evaluating. God even says it explicitly in that famous phrase in 1 Samuel 16, "Man looks on the outward appearance, but God looks on the inward." God looks on the heart. God looks within. He doesn't obsess about the packaging, the wrapping. And it's not to say that looks are not good, okay? Just to reassure some of you who feel obviously crestfallen, for some of us, we might really battle with that. Does this mean that the Bible is anti-beauty, anti-good looks? Not at all. Don't ever believe that. Beauty is a gift from God, and aesthetics are important, a very important gift that God gives to us. The person that tries to live their life without enjoying beauty is going to live a terrible life. God gives these gifts to be enjoyed with thanksgiving, honoring him. The danger is when we turn his gifts into gods. We turn the gift into the God that we bow down to, that we live by, that we build our lives upon, the rock we stand on. Our security and our identity becomes, for example, our looks. It could be. And it often is, in fact. Certainly seems to be so with Absalom. There's a certain kind of arrogance, smugness, authoritarianism that creeps in that I reckon has a lot to do with just how attractive he knows he is. Get away with anything. And that's horribly dangerous, because God does not see it like that at all. He sees it as a gift that he can give and take at any time. We need to humble ourselves before God. And I'd say as well, if in Jerusalem, in sort of 1000 BC, which is the kind of time we're looking at here, you've got a culture that's impressed with the trappings of physical attraction, let's not kid ourselves, 3,000 years later, we haven't moved on much, have we? If anything, we are more impressed. We are obsessive about this. This is huge. In fact, this is the kind of stuff of statistical research. People will look into this kind of thing. There's a guy that used to be in this church, Adam Pearson, a friend of ours, who actually moved away to another city. But he did some work on this. He had a significant skin disfigurement, which affected his appearance quite drastically. And he went into various places of employment with a hidden camera to ask if they had any work. And he would get instant kind of dismissal, instant refusal. No, we don't really work here, sorry. And then straight away they would send in, he did this for Channel 4, send in a superb looking model or someone who's physically attractive to ask for work, ask if they could apply for work. And immediately it's, oh yeah, look, take a seat, application form here, fill it in here if you like, two interviews with you. You see quickly, just by an anecdotal evidence, that the kind of, ugly double standards, the hypocrisy, the shallowness of our evaluation. People like a guy called Dan Hammamesh in the University of Texas in Houston, who did some research on whether or not people who are physically attractive generally get work and pay on a higher level, do better with success than people who are not physically attractive. And he came to the conclusion after research that, definitely. 3 or 4% more on average general income for people who are physically attractive. So that says something about our society. And we don't really need the stats to say it. We can see it. We see it in the media. We definitely see it in social media. We see how much this means to us. And it sways our judgment, forces us to think down paths that we might not realize we're taking. We might not even see ourselves doing it because we're evaluating so much on the outward, on the outwardly impressive, and not looking closely. Perhaps one of the most important verses in the Bible, most important sentences in history, perhaps, on this whole subject is one of the few places that describes Jesus' appearance. Ever thought, what does Jesus really look like? We don't have any photographs. We don't have any reliable paintings. Trust me, the ones you've seen are not reliable. The only place the Bible comes close to describing him is Isaiah 53, where it says, he had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. Jesus, probably not a good-looking guy. I don't know if that affects you at all. I don't know if that disappoints you. Jesus, probably not a good-looking guy. Physically, probably quite plain. Let that get into your soul. Let that affect the way you evaluate people and things, and even yourself and your own judgments and decisions. This is important for us. We look at an absent, we look at someone who is outwardly magnificent. We're looking at a man with no blemish. Man, the more we look at Absalom, the more we realize, has he got blemishes? He is one big fat blemish underneath. Jesus, outwardly plain, without blemish, utterly pure. Be wise in the way you evaluate. This affects us on every level. It affects us on a social, even a political level. The politicians have sussed out that the electorate makes judgments an awful lot on presentation and style and less on substance and conviction. What does the politician really think? We don't really need to know. We just need to know the style. We just need to know the presentation. We need to know whether we kind of like them on a shallow sort of level. Well, any country that chooses its politicians that way will get what it deserves. It's not just on the big political, social level. It happens on the personal level. Our decisions about dating, decisions about future partners. This is huge. You can so easily get snagged. You can get shipwrecked by making daft decisions, all on the basis of something quite shallow. And remember what I said, physical attraction is not unimportant. The Bible's big on beauty. It's a good thing, but it's not the only thing. And it can, in fact, be a trap. It can, in fact, be deceiving. It's certainly not lasting, even with the best creams you can get. It's not going to last forever. And we mustn't make judgments by such fleeting factors, such short-lived things as good looks that really need to tuck in amongst many other things that we should be concerned. In fact, including some things we should be way more concerned about than whether someone is physically attractive to us. Way, way more important. In 20 years' time, you will know which thing should have been most important to you in choosing a partner. So be wise about that. So it affects us on a personal level, it affects us even, like I say, on a political level, and definitely, even with regard to social media, you know, there's more and more voices that come out talking about the danger of fear of missing out, the genuine danger of people living with a certain level of depression. Instagram, I mean, this is like reputable newspapers that are putting out research saying Instagram causes depression. People's level of depression goes up. Why? Because they're spending too much time on Instagram. Why? Why would that happen? Well, of course it will happen. Because what is Instagram? It's everyone showing off. It's everyone presenting the best version of themselves, the best version of their shoes, the best version of their lunch, the best version of their whatever, their new hair, their new look, their new everything, a new house, a new car. And so the fear of missing out, the fear of not being in, not being there, not having what they've got, is only increased in the culture. Came across an interesting article lately. I'll quote to you. There's an image that you should just see on the screen that makes this point quite well. It's just somebody from Australia who put, you probably can't see the text on the screen, so let me read to you. She writes this on this Instagram picture: "Please like this photo. I put on makeup, curled my hair, tight dress, big uncomfortable jewelry, took over 50 shots until I got one I thought you might like. Then I edited this one, a selfie for ages on several apps, just so I could feel some social approval from you. There is nothing real about this." There is nothing real about this. But we'll spend a long time looking at people's not real lives, people's fakeness, and assume from looking at it, they're having an amazing time, they're happy, they're secure, and I should approve of them. In fact, I wish I was them. We're kind of carrying on this vicious circle of gap between reality and presentation, which can cause kind of disharmony on the inside, sense of emptiness and struggle with accepting life. So we've got to see the fakeness just there in the kind of fake glory. That's not the only thing. That's just the first thing. The second thing, fake honor. Fake honor going on here. And you see that in verse 29 and 30. You see it in the whole story in reality. The way that Absalom behaves, he is so full of his honor. He's so full of his importance. If there's one thing he believes in, it's Absalom. I believe in me. I believe in my importance. I believe in my destiny, my self-actualization. I am so vital in the world's affairs. I must be honored. I mustn't be shamed. I mustn't be put to one side. I mustn't be told to wait. You see it really clearly in his story. You read from verse 29. Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king. Joab would not come to him. And he sent a second time, but Joab would not come. Now that's disgraceful. Joab, you called me to Jerusalem. You were the one that fixed it for me to come back. What do you think you're doing? Not answering the phone, not taking my call when I need to see the king. How dare you? He's kind of pushy, isn't he? This is Absalom, right? This is a pushy, pushy, pushy person. You go a bit further down, verse 30. Then he said to his servant, "See, Joab's field is next to mine. He has barley there. Go and set it on fire." So Absalom's servant set the field on fire. Now this is, you know, again, put yourself in that context. This isn't just pranks. This isn't just vandalism. This isn't just kids. This is a barley field. This is your economy. This is an agrarian economy. This is Joab's security. A field of barley is no small thing. What does he do? He sets fire to it. This is like horse's head on the pillow stuff, okay? It's kind of mafia stuff for a generation a few thousand years before. It's that idea, just push, 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 push till you get. Push till your honor is recognized. Push till they accept that you are great. I will be honored. I will be honored. I will have my audience with the king. And anyone that gets in my way, fire, fire. And this is a telling story because it's a bit of a clue as to what Absalom is going to keep on doing. Setting fire to a field is just the beginning. He's going to set fire to the nation. It was a big mistake of Job's to bring Absalom back. When he decided to do that, he definitely caught a tiger by the tail. And he's just realizing now, there's nothing he can do. He can't control this guy. He's got a gang. He's got power now. He's got henchmen. He can't just close him down. I'm going to have to get into the king. He's got force. He's someone to be reckoned with. When we give space to people who are basically obsessive about their honor, well, we're making a mistake, I suggest. And that's what this guy is definitely obsessive about. So different, again, to the true king. So in Absalom, we have a son of David whose own honor causes him to push and push and push. In Jesus, we have another son of David, about whom it said in the New Testament, Philippians chapter 2, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God as something to be grasped, but instead made himself nothing. And having taken on the very nature of a servant, he humbled himself, even to death on a cross. That's our God. That's what God is like. The Son of God, the son of the king, if you like. How does he behave in his position of sonship when he could have everything? He could quite validly have just walked around with Absalom's arrogance, self-confidence. In fact, Jesus was never like that. Jesus waited on the Father to give things into his hand. Jesus was perfectly content waiting on the Father. Does Absalom wait for his Father? Not a second. I will get my audience with the king and I will burn you if you try stopping me. He's pushy. Now here's the thing, friends. How pushy are you? See, we're talking about a guy that 3,000 years ago with crazy hair. We know this is a different culture, a different story. It's not us. But no, this is the reason these stories are in the Bible. God's very kind to us. He tells us our own dangers, yeah? Tells us what will happen if we ultimately become obsessive about our honor. It's about my honor, and it's fake. It's totally false, and it's dangerous. You mustn't live for your honor, my friend. It won't even satisfy you anyway. But you might be doing it without even realizing. We can become really obsessive without even knowing we're doing it. That's definitely this man. He doesn't even realize. He's got no clue about the kind of person he's becoming. You look at that in verse 32, massive irony. At the beginning of verse 32, Absalom answered Joab, behold, I sent word to you, come here, that I may send you to the king to ask, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me to be there still. He's kind of a drama queen. It would be better for me to never come. What's he saying? He's saying he thinks it'd be better, surely, if I'd stayed in Geshur. He's not really saying, he's trying to, you know, kind of make everyone feel awkward. He's being manipulative. But think about it. What he's saying is truer than he realizes. Of course it would be better. Be a lot better if a murderous maniac didn't get let back into Jerusalem. Absalom hasn't got the faintest idea how true it is. All he cares about is his honor. He has no conception of his past, of his shame, of his guilt, of what he's done. No sense that he might actually be lucky to be alive right now. Lucky to be taking a breath right now. But friends, we go through exactly the same patterns of thought so often. I think I go through these patterns of thought myself pretty much daily. When things don't go my way, how outrageous. Instead of, I'm still breathing, how outrageous. I'm still alive. God's forgiven me. God's being kind to me. God's allowing me, a rebel, to live on his planet. Our perspective is so twisted. And we got to learn. God puts these stories in to teach us the danger of being tied up with our honor our honor is fake, it's vain, it's fleeting, it means nothing. There's only one person whose honor we should be concerned for. Only one person. Jesus taught us, our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your name. Absalom never thinks like that. Hallowed be my name. Third and final thing, there's fake glory, fake honor, there's fake reconciliation. You could maybe call it fake remorse at first, which leads to fake reconciliation. You see it in the next part of verse 32. Now therefore, let me go into the presence of the king. And if there is guilt in me, let him put me to death. Again, it's all the kind of manipulative, emotive language. Put me to death, why don't you? What's he saying? He knows, he's clever, he's cunning, he knows the king's never going to put him to death now. He would never have got this far if the king was really prepared to execute a sentence on Absalom. He knows that. So when he says, oh, if there's anything wrong, if there's any guilt in me, feel free to put me to death, it's a bluff. It's a bluff. He knows his father won't do that to him. He knows he's found his father's weakness. So he plays on it. And he pretends to deal with the past. Okay, they say I'm a murderer. Well, put me to death then, why don't you? He's not facing the past. He's not facing the reality. He's not considering the harm he's done, the tragedy he's incurred on the nation, on his family, on his own future, on his own children. Nothing. No concern for that at all. It's all fake. And this is maybe the toughest part of the message because, frankly, that is exactly what religion is like. That's what religion naturally is like. That is what we will do left to ourselves. We will do all the formalities of religion and, oh, I'm sorry for my sin. Even going to church regularly without ever daring to let God shine his light on the real things underneath. Without ever daring to let God look at the past with us. Look at the attitudes and the motives and the things lurking underneath. Goodness, no, I'm not going there. So we keep God at arm's length by doing religious stuff, by pretending to be sorry, going through the motions. Even the way that Absalom goes to see the king, it's all kind of very formal. The way it's done, it's like something staged. You know, we can be this close to a genuine revelation of the real wrongdoing in our heart, the wrong attitudes, the wrong things in the past. We can be that close and still manage all our lives to never see it. You can. You can. You can be completely blind. You can have a marriage, relationship, family life, where everyone knows why the marriage is wrong. Everyone knows, except the person harming the marriage. Everyone. Because the person harming the marriage is willfully blind about it. Just like Absalom. Never going to even consider looking inward, thinking, have I harmed this marriage? Have I done wrong? Do I need to repent? Do I need to change? Let me read you some words from C.S. Lewis, who makes this point. He says this, it's no good passing this over with some vague general admission, such as, of course, I know I have my faults. It's important to realize that there is some really fatal flaw in you, something which gives others the same feeling of despair which their flaws give you. And it's almost certainly something you don't know about, like what the advertisements call halitosis, which everyone notices except the person who has it. But why, you ask, don't the others tell me? You ever felt like that? I've done that in conversations. I found out about something that I've done that was wrong, that wasn't appreciated, that wasn't liked. And I said, well, no one told me. What's going on there? That's a strange kind of fig leaf to hide behind, isn't it? Well, no one told me, so it's their fault. But he says, Lewis, here, believe me, they have tried to tell you over and over and over again, and you just couldn't take it. Perhaps a good deal of what you call their nagging or bad temper are just their attempts to make you see the truth. And even the faults you do know, you don't know fully. You say, I admit I lost my temper last night. But the others know that you're always doing it. That you are a bad-tempered person. You say, I admit I drank too much last Saturday. But everyone else knows that you're a habitual drunkard. See, Absalom is doing this shallow, okay, let's make amends. I'll come back and see the king. I'll bow down. Yeah, I'll bow down. Fine, happy now? Well, God isn't. I wonder about you. I wonder if you've allowed the light of God's scrutiny to just check your heart, to see if there's anything in there. He goes through the motions. I mean, even, you know, David and Absalom, they meet together. David kisses Absalom. Judas kissed Jesus. It doesn't mean anything. You look in the Bible, you see some real reconciliations. Ever had a real reconciliation with somebody? You've ever been brought back in line with someone who you've fallen out with, you've hurt, or they've hurt you, and it's been a broken, ruptured relationship, and then you've been brought together. You look in the Bible, Joseph and his brothers, Jacob and Esau, the stories melt your heart because they're so real. They're so authentic. They're so expressive. There's so much genuine emotion. There's so much genuine talk. This is a million miles from there. Don't settle for fake reconciliation, friends. Don't settle for it. Fake reconciliation with God is terrible. It's a trick. It's a trap. It will not get you anywhere. And fake reconciliation with your brother, your sister, your friends, it's also a trap. Don't settle for it. Don't be satisfied with it. Go for the real. Many years ago, my dad, who's a preacher, he was leading a church a few miles away from here. And there was a lady in the church who left her husband and children to go with someone else, just ran off with another guy. And years later, she came to see him, and it was to do with a physical condition she had. She was in a lot of pain. And he sat down to talk with her. She wanted him to pray for her. You know, she just thought, well, at any port in a storm, I'll go to my old pastor, and he can pray for me. Maybe that'll make it better. He sat down and he talked with her about what happened. And she's kind of skirted over it for years. She talked about the past, but she kind of dropped, you know, there was a gap about what happened when she left her husband. Eventually, she said, well, I left the home and went off with the other guy, but that was all right, she said. That was all right, wasn't it? Wasn't it? And he said to her, no, it was all wrong. And she broke down and cried and said, I know. I've known for years. And she was healed right there. The pain left. She had this moment of reality. I wonder about you. Is there a hidden thing? Is there something you've never thought, well, actually, I should bring that to the light? I like hiding it. I like saying, that's all right. That doesn't matter. I know it's wrong, but it's all right. My friend, that's no way to live. It's no way to live. It will probably bring you into pain of some kind. Absalom never got out of the pain in the end. But there's hope for us. If you're here today, if you're listening, if you're watching this, there's hope for you. See, God is so kind. God will bring to our attention. God will use means. God will find a way to speak to us. And then help us to see what we don't want to see. I guess maybe just to give Absalom a moment's consideration here. Perhaps he just finds it hard to look at the past, yeah? It's a horrible thing to look at the past sometimes. It's a horrible thing to face it. And so we don't. We just glide over it. We drift past it. It's a painful thing. It's like I cannot bear the thought of what I did. I can't go there. I can't. I can't bear the thought that's my destiny. That's what I became. That's what I really am. I'll play another track. I'll be a different person. I put out another personality on social media. I'll go for the fake because it causes me less nightmares. It's less horrible than the reality. But God's too kind to let that happen. Some of us, we feel it in a different way. It's not necessarily because of the past so much. It's just the sense we've had all along that we're not particularly attractive, that we're not acceptable, that we are blemished. We're blemished big time. Our blemishes disqualify us. So we feel kind of left out because of the blemish that's over us. And whether we can face our blemishes or whether we wallow in them, what's the answer? Is the solution that we all just try to be a lot less like Absalom, please, and a lot more like Jesus? There you go. That'll do you for this Sunday. There's no hope there. That's not good news. That's terrible. That's bondage. That's slavery. You'll get nothing out of that. I want you to know Christianity is better than that. The Bible is better than that. The gospel is good news. Good news. The good news is this, that there was somebody who, in the truest sense, was without blemish. Not skin deep, not haircut, without blemish inwardly. And it was important for the world that he should be. Because the God of the Bible introduces himself to his people in the Old Testament, says, if you want to have a relationship with me, you've got to take an animal, you've got to sacrifice it. That sounds harsh to us. We think that's cruelty. And maybe it is a kind of cruelty. It's God making a point. He's saying the distance between us, the bridge to be crossed, the chasm, the separation is so dark. It's so grave. Your wickedness of heart, your sin, your inward blemishes are so serious. And my holiness and purity and perfection are so great and heightened and beyond your understanding. The only way we can deal with this gap is through blood being shed, and it must be an animal without blemish. It's got to be pure. I'm a pure God. So pure, in fact, that like lepers, people with terrible skin disfigurements, there wasn't even a way they could be in the camp. And if you touched a leper, you couldn't even be welcomed into worship. It was horrible. It was a horrible thing. It was the only way God could introduce himself to humankind. Like if we're going to be close, it's going to be painful. It's going to be difficult. We have to have a whole load of laws about cleanliness and holiness and purity and defilement and shame and uncleanness and dishonor and bloodshed and all this whole thing. If you read the Old Testament, some of those descriptions are gory. Because God's saying, this is gory. Sin, your heart is so messed up. We can't be friends. We can't. You can't just wave and come in. The problem is way deeper than that. So we have to take an animal without blemish. And the priest would say, I find no fault in this animal. And it would be waved through and they would kill the animal and there would be forgiveness. Until this man came, Jesus. The Bible says that he is without blemish. If you touched a leper, you would be taking on their uncleanness for a few days. You couldn't even be in society if you touched a leper. But Jesus comes down from the mountain, Matthew chapter 8, after teaching the crowds, and he touches this leper. This leper says, if you want to, you can heal me. Jesus says, oh yeah, I want to. And he doesn't just say, be healed from a distance. He goes right up to him, sticks his hand on him. What? Aren't you unclean now? Well, no, actually, because Jesus isn't unclean on the inside. The problem is on the inside. There was never the skin in the first place. Jesus hasn't got that magnetism of sin on the inside to connect with the defilement on the outside. Jesus is completely without blemish. So this leper, instead of infecting Jesus, is infected by Jesus with righteousness, with healing. Jesus is that powerful. He can take the worst things about us, things that make us feel horrified with ourselves, things that we actually hate about ourselves. We really hate about ourselves, don't we? Sometimes. And frankly, we should if we're anything like this man, and we all are to some extent. Jesus, the one without blemish, took them on himself and went to the cross. This lamb was taken. And you know, the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, just like the priest of the Old Testament, when Jesus was being taken away to be crucified, what did he say? I find no fault in this man. There's nothing wrong with him. Nothing wrong with him. He takes on himself all our wrongdoing, all our shame, all our sin, so that we can be presented in the New Testament's word, in Colossians chapter 1, verse 22, where it says that he's able to present us before the Father free from blemish and without accusation. That means if you feel like, you know, I can't look within, I can't look at the past, I can't be real, I'm scared of what it would, I cannot bear the thought of being real about myself and my heart and my shame and my guilt. You don't have to fear it, because there's someone who's given you his righteousness, given it to you freely, makes you new on the inside. So whatever, what habits, what addictions, what stuff trips you up, what relationships, what things you're involved with that you know you shouldn't be, and you think, I can't bear the thought. What would God think of me if I can't, what would the Christians think of me? No, that's not, in the end, what God will think of you will be nothing to do with your past. Because if you belong to Jesus Christ, God sees you as righteous, without blemish, without accusation. And you can learn to just accept his grace, receive a new identity. This is how we find hope. This is how we find peace with God, in spite of all the things that would say otherwise. You can be friends with God. Let's just pray together. Father, we thank you for this story, and we thank you for what it tells us about ourselves and about you. And we pray in the name of your Son, Jesus, that you would teach us to live in the good of all the grace you give. In Jesus' name, amen.